You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The Assad regime and Russia are reducing Aleppo to rubble. Aleppo's inhabitants are ordinary Syrians. They are now facing an unprecedented, unrelenting onslaught of cruelty. And it is increasingly clear that it is an onslaught beyond the capabilities of the Syrian Air Force alone.
Three UN ambassadors walk out of the Security Council in protest at Russia's complicity in the demolition of Aleppo. Is Moscow likely to care? My guests Isabel Hilton and James Boyes will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including a planet braces itself for the first US presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. France threatens and or promises yet again to close the migrant camp outside Calais. And one of the world's longest running wars comes to a formal conclusion. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, CEO of China Dialogue, and James Boyes, historian and author, most recently and most pertinently, of Hillary Rising. Welcome both, and we will start with Hillary Clinton, who is now hours away from having to try conducting a reasoned conversation in public with Donald Trump, a feat approximately congruent with attempting to nail custard to the ceiling. The first presidential debate looms as polls suggest that swelling numbers of grown adults are considering voting for the Orange game show host. James, first of all, this is a no-lose situation for Donald Trump, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
as long as he actually gets through the show without actually punching one of the moderators, and I think for quite a lot of his fan base that would play quite well. He can't go backwards here, can he?
No, one of the challenges you have here is that the levels of expectation for both the candidates are very, very different. The bar is set much higher for Hillary Clinton and much lower for Donald Trump. Not too dissimilar, it must be said, from the situation we faced in 2000 when Al Gore faced George W. Bush. The smarter candidate has a tougher job on her hands in this case, which is how do you debate, if we can use that expression, because of course they won't actually be talking to one another, but probably at one another. How do you enter into debate with Donald Trump, especially when you don't know which Donald Trump is going to show up?
Indeed.
Throughout the primaries, we saw two very different Donald Trumps, a very bombastic, in-your-face Donald Trump on several occasions, but also a Donald Trump who, on occasion, disappeared into the background. Now, he could afford to do that when he was surrounded by 12, 13, 14 other Republicans to a certain extent. He cannot do that tonight. His new team who've come in surrounding him have tried to get him to be, quote-unquote, more presidential. Yet at the same time, he needs to be Donald Trump to appeal to his base. He has actually got quite a tough task in that regard. He doesn't want to come across as too hostile, I think, to Hillary Clinton physically, because that very much doomed her Republican opponent in the 2000 Senate race and led to a sympathy movement for Hillary. So it's going to be a fascinating, fascinating performance and 90 minutes on stage at Hofstra University tonight.
Isabel Hilton, poll after poll on Donald Trump's supporters has shown that they are entirely aware of his flaws and foibles and that they simply don't care. That being the case, what weak points can Hillary Clinton profitably go after?
Well, I think it's extraordinarily tough for her because whatever she does, she's in a way on the defensive. You know, they're judged by different standards. If she plays to her strengths, she's going to come across as, you know, kind of lecturing. And it's very hard to explain policy in these things anyway. It's very hard to show seriousness without being boring. And all he has to do is be mildly entertaining. And he's going to, in current terms, he's going to win. So I think it's very tough for her. I think her best shot, really, is trying to get under his skin and get him to lose his temper, because I think that would show up in some kind of way, not with his hardcore supporters, but people would, you know, if he's a man who can't keep his temper in a televised debate, do you really want him to have his finger on the button? You know, I mean, there are serious issues here, after all. But I think it's very tough for her.
James, what does or should Hillary do in the not unlikely event that Donald Trump goes off on one of his riffs in which he makes lots of vague but not terribly well-defined accusations, just starts hurling up the chaff, sort of says lots of people are asking the question, some people are saying that. How does she respond if he goes on one of his sort of vague, diffuse but kind of overwhelming attacks?
I think that with regard to Hillary Clinton, if she has a failing, it's that she's a one-gear candidate. She's very good in that gear, but she doesn't necessarily have an awful lot in her backpack, effectively, to pull upon. But what she has done effectively with regard to that exact point, and she did it in a speech in San Diego shortly after she got the nomination, is that she outlines what the world's problems are, what Donald Trump's inability to address them is, and how she would address them. And I think that she needs to take that quite analytical approach with regard to that sort of meandering, chaotic approach that Donald Trump is likely to adopt, and to round it all up and say, you know, take a line out of Ronald Reagan. When Ronald Reagan debated Jimmy Carter in 1980, you had the same thing. You had a former entertainer turned politician facing a rather pious incumbent politician who represented the status quo. And whenever Carter started lecturing Ronald Reagan, he turned around and said, well, there you go again. Now, it sounds like an easy throwaway line, but it went down like a storm in 1980. And I think that there's an extent to which Hillary Clinton needs to draw upon that rather simplistic humor. And if she can just do that and interject a degree of humanity into her performance, you couple that with an innate intelligence, that could do her well, I think.
Isabel, there's been a lot of chat about what role the moderators should play, because it's not going to be akin to my job here, which is just basically getting two sort of obviously intelligent and informed and reasonable people to conduct a conversation. Should they step in? Should they be empowered to step in, not when, but let's face it, if Donald Trump just starts saying things, which he's just, because this is what he does, he just makes things up.
You might,
everybody knows this, but should they be empowered to actually say, excuse me, Mr. Trump, that's just flat out wrong?
Well, in my view, they should. But the worrying trend is that they're rather ruling this out, that they're not going to play umpire, as they put it. And that's up to the candidates. So, and that puts Hillary again in the impossible position of trying to fact check everything that Donald Trump says and trying to catch him out in his lies, which again puts her on the defensive. So I think it's very, I think it's an abrogation, honestly, of what was already a rather kind of worn out formula. It's an abrogation of their responsibility in this. But it's one that we've seen throughout the campaign, where Trump has had this, you know, miles of rope and not being required to hang himself by the media who just love the ratings. So I think, it's part of his built-in advantage in the current media landscape. And I think, you know, he's obviously going to play it. And as you say, this trope he has about, you know, I'm not saying it, but lots of people are asking, or somebody told me, I read it on the internet. But I mean, there are serious, you know, we're just watching a kind of appalling endgame in Syria. What is either candidate going to say about that? This is Putin, Trump's best friend, it would appear, you know, is escalating a humanitarian and catastrophe in Syria. You know, there's no straightforward solution, but he has in the past said that he'd put 30,000 ground troops in there. Would he really do that? Is he going to be asked about that? Are the 30,000 ground troops he'd put in going to take on his friend Putin's forces in Syria? You know, he is very exposed if you had anchors who were prepared to use their authority.
It's important to recognise, you use the word, should we empower them? They are empowered, and they are deliberately disempowering themselves. They have taken the repeated position that it's not my job to be fact checker, hall monitor, as it were. Indeed, the Fox anchor who's going to be anchoring one of the debates categorically said that in an interview. The role of the moderator in debates has been very problematic. 4 years ago, Candy Crawley arguably went too far and offered Donald Trump a lifeline when Mitt Romney seemed to have him skewered at one point in regard to how long it had taken the administration to refer to, I think it was attack on Benghazi, as terrorism. A few weeks ago, Matt Lauer basically was seen to have fumbled when he didn't call Donald Trump at the at the commander-in-chief debate when he had said and repeated a claim he said before about being opposed to the Iraq war all along. So we have a problem here, which is, you know, to what extent should the moderators step in and say, hang about a second, you're categorically wrong there. And throughout this process, Donald Trump has benefited massively, it must be said, from a very, very tame media who have been ill-prepared to take him to task upon a series of daily outbursts, which I think would have ruined any of the candidacy.
Okay, well, we will doubtless have ample opportunity to discuss the debate once it's actually happened, but now let's turn to the UN, where there has been grand drama in the shape of a proper old-school flout. The ambassadors of the United States, the United Kingdom and France have mounted their highest horses and taken their leave of a meeting of the Security Council after accusing Russia and Syria of war crimes. Other notably undiplomatic language was deployed, including such terms as barbarity and bloodlust. Isabel, the barbarity and bloodlust in Syria has been going on for 5 years, with Russia's assistance for at least two of those. Why are we only getting indignant about this now?
Well, I think we have been indignant, but I think that we are looking at a real catastrophe. I mean, there's been an escalation in the bombing, there's been an escalation in the weaponry, they've hit the water supply. You are looking at you know, a terrible humanitarian crisis, and it would appear preparations for a ground assault on Aleppo. So you are looking at a kind of order of a magnitude of suffering, which is far greater than it has been, although it has, as you say, been horrible for 5 years. Now, what are the options? You know, they flounced out, but, you know, on their high horses, but where did they gallop to? It's absolutely
There's a stable door extension to this metaphor somewhere.
If we could only, you know, get it into line. So it seems to me that they've got two options. One is to take some military action, and the other is sanctions against Russia, because at the moment, neither the Syrian regime nor Russia are experiencing any negative consequences, except reputationally, which clearly they're not that bothered about, for their actions. So either, you know, we take action of some sort, or we accept that Russia and Syria are playing this out to the end without any consequences.
James, does the reputational aspect make any difference to Russia, do we think? UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson has explicitly suggested that Syria and Russia are guilty of war crimes. Is there any reason to imagine that anyone in Moscow or Damascus will care in the least what Boris Johnson thinks?
I think we need to take the personality out of this. It's very easy, I think, to have a laugh at Boris Johnson, but fundamentally he represents the view of Her Majesty's Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which is a bit more important, I think. I think we do need to see, you know, the diplomatic importance of this. It's very easy to sort of laugh at this and say, oh, well, you know, we trance out and whatever. But there has clearly been an agreement out of Paris, London and Washington, D.C. that diplomatically enough is enough at the United Nations. And that is, I know it sounds a little bit weak, you know, an effective slap to Russia within the diplomatic community. You know, if you look at how some of these things are worded, even relatively mild wording sends diplomatic repercussions. Now, you know, if you're one of the terribly unfortunate people in Aleppo or anywhere in Syria, quite frankly, this all looks like window dressing, which of course it is. But this, unfortunately, is how the great game is played. Russia already is under sanction, quite frankly, at this point. I think the great challenge now is, you know, we're in, you know, a very problematic time period. We're about to enter, you know, the final stage of a presidential election, and nobody's imagining anything is going to happen this side of the inauguration, which is not November, of course, but the back end of January. So really, Obama's ability to manipulate and to push events here, I think, has very much ended. So we're now looking to a point where either President Trump or President Hillary Clinton is going to be having to pick up the ball, which has been so terribly dropped, it must be said, by the entire Obama administration throughout the entire duration of his second term.
But that's the problem. We've got, of those three ambassadors who walked out, you know, two are actually facing election because there's a presidential election coming up in France and in the United States. And the British government has its own preoccupations. So
we could have a snap election in England, of course.
We could indeed.
Sorry, Great Britain.
But the problem is that Putin knows that too, and Putin is pretty secure that in the knowledge that nothing dramatic is likely to happen for 5 months. probably, until the politics reassemble themselves.
James, this may get us towards our high horses stable door moment here, but as you said, Obama, for reasons of some understandable, some less so, has to an extent sat out the civil war in Syria. Is there a parallel reality in which things might be better or at least different if at one of the several points at which the Syrian regime crossed one of the so-called red lines, Obama had actually said, okay, that's enough?
It's possible. Let's be honest. I mean, things could be a lot worse. I mean, this is one of the great problems about, you know, going into, you know, this sort of speculation about history. It's remarkable that if you take Obama's ultimate excuse about why nothing happened, ultimately always he's Ed Miliband's fault.
Well, yeah.
Which is quite a remarkable thing to consider.
Often forgotten.
Often forgotten. Let's be honest about this. If the President of the United States had wanted to act at any point, he would have done so. And using the suggestion that British Parliament wouldn't support him is never going to hold water, quite frankly. He clearly made a decision, not to get involved. The extent to which that was done for domestic reasons, the extent to which it was done for Obama's legacy reasons, you know, are very, very complicated and complex indeed. Clearly, Obama has basically bet his entire presidency upon not basically wanting to overextend U.S. foreign policy and U.S. force into another nation in that part of the world, or antagonize Russia. I think he realizes it's a hiding to nowhere domestically. Quite frankly, we have someone running for the presidency this year, polling at 9%, who does not know where or what Aleppo is. What does that tell you about the knowledge level of the American people, and therefore the extent to which they have not been educated by this president about its importance?
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Isabel Hilton and James Boyes. Coming up next, France again attempts to say farewell to the jungle.
Design Diaries at the ready. You've got an appointment to keep. Tuesday, the 18th of October at 1900 marks the latest in our series of live broadcasts from our Marylebone headquarters. It's our weekly design show. It's Section D and it's live. Join me, Josh Fennett, and a host of panellists, including famed typographer Eric Speakerman and the V&A's Joanna Agerman-Ross, among others, for a glass of wine and an evening of lively debate on the future of the design industry. Section D Live. For tickets and information, head to monocle.com/events.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late-night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and James Boyes. Now, President Francois Hollande of France has vowed to completely dismantle the so-called jungle, the shanty town of migrants and refugees on the outskirts of Calais. President Hollande has further vowed that this time he really, totally, definitely means it, possibly becoming nervous that if he makes this promise one more time without keeping it, Aesop will write a fable about him. Isabel, he says, this time it will be dismantled before winter. We assume he means this winter. That gives him about 6 weeks. Do we believe him?
Well, I think this promise is not unrelated to the fact that that Sarkozy was in the jungle last week and there's a presidential election coming up. So, you know, this is why it's happening. Do we believe him? Well, what's going to happen to the 10,000 people? They say 7, everyone else says 10, who are there? He's talking about distributing them in smaller centres around the country. He's also making threatening noises to the United Kingdom, saying, you know, if you think we're going to play nice with this forever, we're not. Now, I don't think that he's very convincing on this, given that he hasn't actually done anything very much about it for the last 4 years. So I think that you might close it down. It'll pop up somewhere else, you know, unless he really does supply the people there with some other alternative, which they are prepared to accept. It's not going to happen. They're there because they want to be within striking distance of the United Kingdom.
And also because I suspect France is not terribly keen to discourage them in that ambition. It never struck me as coincidental, James, that France managed to see this camp established at about the closest point imaginable to Great Britain, with everything but big signs and arrows saying United Kingdom that way.
Absolutely, with everything you'd ever want laid on for free. Who says that Barack Obama does not have an international reputation that's worth emulation? Here we have a left-of-centre president talking about closing down a camp, and he's about to do it in the blink of an eye. Well, Barack Obama has been saying this for 8 years, it must be pointed out, and Guantanamo Bay is still open and doubtless will remain open long after the Obamas are back in Illinois, which looks like where they're going to resettle. I dare say also that the jungle will remain open come the beginning of the next administration next year. Quite frankly, Elon can jump up and down and shout as much as
not
he likes
very
about
high,
this.
Though, obviously.
Not very high, yeah. Which is one of the reasons that he's able to do so, of course, because he's no threat to anybody. Neither, of course, is Sarkozy, because, of course, he's also a somewhat diminutive lover of heeled shoes, as I understand. So there's no doubt, I think, that Elon sees a threat coming from the French right and is saber-rattling as a result of this. His ability to be able to do much about it, I think, is somewhat limited. So I don't think anybody should be seeing the jungle shut down anytime soon.
It's a narrative which is being repeated across the Western world these last few years, of course. Isabel, how do we get to a point in which a large, largely secure, largely prosperous, orderly and wealthy country like France manages to become so exercised about somewhere between 7,000 to 10,000 extremely poor people living in tents?
It's a very good question. And you know, if you look at the any way you play the figures, so if you look at the number of refugees per head of population in France, it's relatively low. Only Britain is lower. You know, many, many countries have taken the have taken a far greater proportion of refugees. But the thing you have to look at is the strength of the right wing, because it's the right wing, it's the you know, the threat from the nationalists in France, who, like UKIP, you know, tend to exaggerate whatever threat they see in these refugees. They tend to talk in language which suggests that the country's being swamped, that, you know, there's this unstoppable tide. It's simply not supported by the figures, but it creates a political momentum, which means that people have to go on making these gestures. You know, the last time Hollande, he closed down 50% of the jungle 6 months ago, and there are more people there than ever before. So, you know, it's absolutely ineffective, but it's all about headlines and politics.
James, it's a question I think that bedevils every vaguely leftish liberal political party now in the Western world. Is there a way of addressing immigration without trying to run rightwards on it? Do you need to pander to the anti-immigration vote?
Well, I think the challenge is, if you look at the response from governments around the world, the suggestion would be that might not be possible. Clearly, I think one of the challenges you face is, you know, we're talking about, you know, the danger from the right wing, is that what you're seeing is even mainstream moderate right wing parties are being pulled rightward by the rhetoric that's coming from the further right, you know, whether that's Le Pen's party in France, or whether it's UKIP here in the United Kingdom. You know, it's an increasing challenge, and what you want to see, obviously, is, you know, a sense of unity coming from the centre, effectively. But as long as, you know, the centre right is getting pulled rightward because of concerns amongst its sort of base electorate, I think the pursuit of power is going to trump, sorry, no pun intended, any sort of clear thinking upon this for the foreseeable future.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we should look at something that gives every appearance of being a good news story. Today, Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos and the leader of narco-Marxist militia FARC, who currently trades under the nom de guerre of Timoshenko, will formally sign, using a pen made from a bullet, the treaty that ends more than half a century of war. Isabel, is there any reason to worry that this won't stick, as far as we can tell?
Ooh, where would I begin? Yes, there are quite a few reasons to worry. The first hurdle...
I was trying to cheer everybody up.
No, it is undoubtedly a good news story. But, you know, there is history to this, of course. Well, the first hurdle is to get it through the referendum. Figures are looking a little better, despite the fact that former President Uribe is campaigning against. He's campaigning against because he objects to the idea that that former FARC guerrilla could go into politics without going to jail first. Now, the record on this, actually, I would be worried if I were the FARC, because when M19 did exactly this deal, they disbanded, they disarmed, and they became a regular political party. You know, about 3 years later, 1,000 of them had been assassinated, including their presidential candidate, who was gunned down, bizarrely, by a young man with a submachine gun on an Avianca flight 10 minutes out of Bogota. So if you're checking into Avianca, you might want to take a look at your fellow passengers. And they were pretty much gunned down by the kind of groups that Uribe in his time patronized, which are the right-wing paramilitaries, who are the other big problem in Colombia. Now, we talk about the FARC being involved in the cocaine trade. So were the right-wing. So were the paramilitary. In fact, the cocaine cartels use the paramilitary to clear people off their land, to actually enforce their will on Colombian politics. So although, you know, this is as a headline deal, this is a very, very promising and necessary first step. There are all kinds of problems down the road. They include millions of internally displaced people who have been driven off their land, largely by the war, but also explicitly by the far right. And they have no title to the land. They remain internally displaced within Colombia. What's going to happen to them? Are they going to go back? Are they going to get their land back? There are all the economic activities that the FARC actually operated, including illegal mining, you know, quite apart from the cocaine traffic. They had, you know, they had a big swathe of the country. Who's going to move into those operations? You know, the government has never held much sway in the FARC-occupied territories. So, you know, there are a lot of questions about how it will pan out.
James, this is due to be ratified by a referendum on October the 2nd. We don't need any instruction in this country at the moment about referendums and how they can rather go off in one's face. Is that wise?
Well, you know, if you believe in democracy, it's not a bad thing. I think that referenda generally have got an odd track record. And of course, an awful lot depends upon how you structure the question. It's not always a given, of course, because many people assume that the way that the question with regard to the European referendum was phrased, that it would lead to a decision to remain in.
So you think maybe if they go with a question like, do you wish to consign Colombia to another half century of pointless expense? Bloodshed.
We are getting into yes minister territory, but yes, quite frankly, an awful lot of this has to depend upon how you phrase the question, and are you looking for a positive response from that wording? And when you do that, history reveals that you do tend to get the sort of response that I think you and I would look for from Colombia.
Isabel, just a final thought on this, in which you've got about 30 seconds to answer an incredibly complex question. Are there any lessons from the Colombia process which might be exportable elsewhere, say, for example, to Syria? Does it give us hope for all conflicts?
Well, in a way, it gives us hope for all conflicts. But I think the primary lesson is that this doesn't happen unless both sides are weary of the alternatives. And I think that these peace processes take when the other thing isn't working. Right now in Syria, I don't see that.
Isabel Hilton and James Boyce, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all for today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's more music next at 1900, our weekly design programme section D, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.